Well, the Vancouver Olympics are looming ever closer. And so is the reality of what it's actually going to be like in Vancouver during February 2010. If you're looking to be publicly critical of the Games, or of anything for that matter during that time, you may be shushed, asked to leave, arrested, or even have your group infiltrated. To defend the rights of those wanting to speak out and protest during the Games, some local organizations are getting prepared. The Pivot Legal Society and the BC Civil Liberties Association are joining up to train people to be legal observers during the Games. David Eby is the Executive Director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. He joins us in the studio to tell us more about their plans to train legal observers. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me.
So things are coming down to the crunch for the Olympics. What do you think it's going to be like in this town for those interested in protesting during the 2010 Games?
Well, I think your introduction really hits the nail on the head. We are only beginning to become aware of the true implications of the new bylaws passed by the City of Vancouver, contracts that were signed years ago that we're just starting to get through freedom of information requests, and agreements made with the International Olympic Committee. In particular, I'm thinking of the host city agreement, which was signed by then-Mayor Larry Campbell, in which he promised that the City of Vancouver would prevent international media and spectators at the Olympics from seeing political propaganda, either inside or outside of the venues. Now, political propaganda sounds like something that might be concerning to some people, but political propaganda really means anything with a political message at all. So if you have Free Tibet on your T-shirt, this is something that the mayor promised would not be inside of Olympic venues, but also would not be outside of Olympic venues. And that's why the new city's bylaws make sense in terms of them passing these restrictions on the kinds of signs that you can hold, the messages on the signs, making it an offense to create a disturbance that interferes with someone's enjoyment of Olympic entertainment. These kinds of things only make sense when you realize the contracts that were signed years ago, and we're just starting to really tap into what's going on.
So tell me a little bit more about these new bylaws, when they were introduced, and what they contain.
The bylaws were introduced about a month and a half ago by the City of Vancouver Council and passed almost unanimously. COPE voted against. And the bylaws basically set out an area of about 40 square city blocks where their special Olympic rules apply. Now, these zones can be expanded without notice by the city engineer, and the rules within the zones can be changed without notice by the city manager. The rules for behavior inside the zones include that you are not allowed to have a sign that is not a celebratory sign, and celebratory sign is defined in the bylaw as one that increases positive feeling about the Olympic Games. That you
seriously?
Are not allowed to, yeah, seriously, you're not allowed to create a disturbance that interferes with someone's enjoyment of the Olympic Games or the Olympics. So when you put those two things together, functionally protests are made illegal by these bylaws. No disturbance, so no shouting slogans and no holding signs. So I suppose you're allowed to protest as long as you stand and walk around quietly, your protest slogans to yourself. But this also gives some context to the so-called what are they called now? Safe assembly zones. They used to be called free speech zones, and we called them protest pens, but now government has changed the names of them to safe assembly zones, saying, well, you're free to protest anywhere, but police will be facilitating protesters into safe assembly zones because it's very dangerous outside of these safe assembly zones to protest. Of course, all the Olympic ticket holders will be in these dangerous areas, but we want to keep the protesters safe in the safe assembly zones, and that's why the police will be facilitating their use. Well, we're very concerned about anyone who suggests that people's right to protest is limited in public space, let alone limited to zones, because last time we saw that was the Beijing Olympics when everyone said it was such an outrage, but apparently in Canada it's for your own safety.
Well, that's very nice of them to think of protesters' safety. I'm a little bit skeptical about that. Is the city passing this bylaw because of that host city agreement and these contracts that were previously signed? Is that your understanding of they're just sort of following through on something that had happened years ago?
That is my understanding, but it's just speculation. I mean, nobody has said this is the reason we're passing these bylaws, but otherwise they don't make any sense. We have a bunch of people on council who are former labor activists or former environmental activists. They know the importance of protest. They know the importance of free speech, so it's hard to know why they would pass these bylaws. on their own volition if they didn't believe that they were possibly going to be sued for not passing them. But that's also a bit of a joke, because the fact that the mayor thought that he could sign away free speech rights in a contract years ago is something that he might have thought, but he can't do it. Constitutionally, he's not allowed to sign away our free speech rights to the International Olympic Committee or anybody else. It's just simply not the mayor's right to give away your free speech rights. So when Larry Campbell signed that contract, he didn't actually have the power to do what he pretended, I guess, that he did.
And you only just found the contents of that contract recently through Freedom of Information? Or?
That's right. So that contract we got through Freedom of Information. We found out later it was posted on a hidden area of the city's website. But all of the appendices to the contract we also got through Freedom of Information, and they haven't been posted anywhere. This includes something called the Clean Venue Agreement, which the IOC has attached as a mandatory part of the contract. It says that, you know, we might tolerate one person with a t-shirt that says Free Tibet incidentally without asking them to cover it up. But if there is a coordinated effort that is more than one person wearing the same t-shirt, if the person uses the t-shirt as a sign or has a seat cover that has a political message on it, and they start waving it around to get attention, that they should be ejected from the venue, because the venues are supposed to be political message free. In addition, the Clean Venue Agreement also sets out the VANOC. The Olympic Committee is supposed to appoint teams of volunteers, 10 teams of two, that will go around the city and police violations of the use of the Olympic trademark. So use of the rings, use of other trademark things like parts of the national anthem with glowing hearts, like Vancouver 2010. And so they're going to be going around, and the contract also sets out that they should attempt to seize materials that they believe violate these trademark violations. So you have volunteers deciding what should and what can and can't be said on t-shirts, signs that might be brand violations, and potentially attempting to seize them from citizens, which we believe would be theft. There's a very clear process that's set out for trademark violations. You go to court, you call the police. You don't just walk up to somebody and try to take their stuff because you think it's a violation. And nor is it clear in the document that there's a difference between a commercial violation and a political violation. If I have the Olympic rings and some kind of satirical situation on my political sign, then are these people going to try to seize my sign from me? This is all stuff, I'm not making it up. It's set out very clearly in the documentation that was signed by the City of Vancouver. There's no indication that anybody asked for an amendment or an exemption or anything like that to any of these clauses. And if anyone's curious, they can read all the documents for themselves on the Civil Liberties website.
And is all this bylaw passing and all these regulations, are any of them legal, in your opinion?
It's our opinion, no. And we're currently consulting with lawyers on fast-tracking some litigation to challenge the worst parts of the bylaws, where they restrict free expression. The other parts of the bylaws, where they suggest that people are subject to additional searches on public property and that kind of thing, we'll probably have to wait until after the Olympics, but we want to focus on the parts that we can get challenged as immediately as possible. We're facing some pretty tight timelines. Normally it takes a year to get into court. These were passed at the very last minute. And they're very serious legal issues that might take a while to litigate, but we need to get it done, obviously, before February of 2010.
Is this stuff that you were anticipating, or does this go far beyond what you were even thinking they were going to pull?
Well, I'm on the record, and kind of embarrassingly, with a filmmaker named Conrad Schmidt, who shot a movie called Five Ring Circus. And in that movie, in his archival footage, he has me saying, you know, I don't think that anyone actually believes that they're going to jail the homeless in the lead up to the Olympics, or that protests will be made illegal. But there will probably be restrictions put in place, and we need to be ready for those. But here I am, months out from 2010, being proven completely wrong, the housing minister introducing legislation that will in fact jail homeless people, and the City of Vancouver passing bylaws that does make protest illegal. So it turns out that I was wrong, and disappointingly so. This far exceeds anything that I ever expected to be passed. And you know, you might think that it would happen, sort of an over-enthusiastic sergeant in charge would lead a brigade against a group of protesters, and then you say, oh, that guy really screwed up. But to see actual bylaws and provincial laws passed of this nature is really alarming.
And the jailing of the homeless, you're referring to forcing people into shelters in cold weather. Is that the sort of front?
That's correct. Yeah. So you're talking about if we get 5 days of rain in a row and there's a declaration of extreme weather, the police having the ability to force people into shelter. And if they refuse to report to the nearest homeless shelter, that they should be arrested and put in jail for the crime of being homeless and refusing to go to a homeless shelter. A very important consideration is that these people are making a very sane and rational decision that they'd rather be in a tent or a sleeping bag on the sidewalk than in some of the difficult conditions in many of our underfunded shelters.
And so the other thing I wanted to touch on was about this these reports about how police are not denying that they might be infiltrating groups with agents provocateurs. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's another. I mean, I get so tired of saying that this is another alarming civil liberties issue, but here we are, another alarming civil liberties issue around the Olympics. We sent a letter to CSIS and to the Integrated Security Unit. We also met with the Integrated Security Unit. We asked them point blank. We said, look, there was a situation in Montebello, Quebec, where a Sûreté du Québec, dressed like protesters, put on balaclavas, carried around rocks, people were concerned that they were attempting to instigate or increase the confrontation between protesters and police and put people at risk. I would say, will you guarantee to us that you will not use agents provocateurs, that you will not use people who will escalate the tension between police and protesters with the aim of giving police opportunity to charge into the crowd of protesters and beat everybody up? And you'd think it would be a no-brainer, right? You'd think they'd say, well, of course we're not going to do that. We're going to give our officers very clear instructions not to do anything that would jeopardize the safety of any protesters, that wouldn't escalate tensions between police and protesters. Excuse me. That would be a no-brainer. But instead they said, we're going to be operating within the terms of Canadian law. And there are some interpretations of Canadian law that would allow them to pay people who would be involved in agent provocateur activities. And also, police are allowed to break the law under Canadian law. And if you look at the Montebello situation, nobody was criminally charged out of that. That was completely tolerated by local police and prosecutors, and there was no consequence for anybody. So at the very least, the RCMP is reserving the right to walk around with balaclavas carrying rocks during the Olympics, which is very concerning to us.
Hoy. So that's a lot of... It's a lot of things to work on, and you've come up with some plans in terms of how to deal with this. You talked about, going to court, and another one of your plans is to organize teams of legal observers on the street. Can you tell us more about how you came up with that plan in response to some of these conditions?
Yeah, I think the major issue we're identifying is that there's a huge gap between these contracts that we've obtained through FOI, the commitments that have been made, the materials that VanOck sent out to the cities along the Torch Run saying don't allow leafleting along the Torch Run. So there's a gap between those written materials and then the public relations that are being done by City of Vancouver, VanOck, provincial government. Don't worry, we would never do this. It's not how it seems. We wouldn't enforce the bylaws as they're written. Those parts of the contract, we would never tell our brand police to seize things from people. You'll be allowed to protest wherever you like. We're just setting these up for your own safety. It's the gap between these written documents and the public assurances that causes us to believe that we need people on the ground to say, hold on a sec, you said this, but what we're actually seeing on the ground is something completely different. It's based on programs out of the United States, a group called the Lawyers Guild, which does legal observing, which is also based on human rights observing around the world. They use them most effectively at the Republican National Convention in the States. A couple observers were unfortunately arrested during that, but they managed to provide documentation that had a number of protesters released from assault police charges because it was clearly documented on videotape that they didn't assault any police officers, that in fact they were on the receiving end of the assaults. So at the very least, it's our hope that the materials will be able to use to protect protesters against false charges, that they will document any potential rights violations during the Olympic Games, and international media and local media will at least have the opportunity to report that out or people to see it for themselves on YouTube, and also that we could potentially form a cautionary tale for future Olympic cities and say, well, we thought we were going to be a socially sustainable games. We thought we were going to be a free speech games. We weren't, but you can learn from our mistakes. And here are the worst of the things that happened, and here are the best of the things that happened from our observing. And here's how you can learn from our errors.
And so would you be using any of that documentation to form any kind of overall legal case in terms of...
You know, it's very possible that this will go to some sort of formal complaint process afterwards if there are the rights violations that we anticipate seeing. APEC, of course, led to a formal public inquiry at which there was months of testimony, videotape evidence from police officers. I think that it's very likely that the material will end up in court proceedings of one kind or another, and so it's being collected with that in mind. We're going to be doing a lot of wide shots that cover all of the action. We're going to be recording our notes in a very neutral fashion so that they will have as much credibility as possible in court. Our goal is to provide a documentation of what happened during the Olympic Games from the other side of the police line, because the police line side is always very well documented.
And so how is it actually going to look? So someone, you know, say I was interested in volunteering as a legal observer, how would the process work, and then what would I actually be doing if I was a volunteer?
Yeah, we had our first workshop on Sunday. We had 50 people out. It's a two-hour workshop. We're hoping to train 100 people, though at the rate we're going, we might train closer to 200. The goal is we'll have at least 25 teams of two out during the games. The assignments will be coming out of the BC Civil Liberties Office, and we'll be directing people to particular hotspots, whether there are protests expected or just areas where the public's interacting with security forces, or perhaps we've had a complaint about a particular area. People will attend. They'll be wearing our bright orange Legal Observer t-shirts with video cameras and still cameras and notebooks, and they'll be documenting what they see in all of those different formats. It's a very passive role. It's standing back and watching the action as it takes place. We ask people not to participate in the protest, not to chant along or carry signs regardless of their political beliefs, because our hope is that the observers are simply involved in an observing role, and that this will strengthen the evidence if necessary for any inquiry or court case later on. That's the involvement. You do the two-hour workshop, you do a two-hour refresher before the games, you make the commitment that you're going to be neutral in your participation when you're wearing the observer uniform, and then you're assigned out into the street, and you record the observations as best that you can. We need people in the office and out of the office, so if people have physical limitations, they don't need to worry about that. There are lots of different roles, and they should send an email to info@bccla.org if they want more information.
And what other plans do you or other organizations that you know of have to ensure that civil liberties and civil rights are respected during the games?
We're working in close partnership on the legal observing with Pivot Legal Society. Pivot's focus is, of course, the downtown east side and homelessness, people who are living on the streets, sex trade workers, and they will be watching to make sure that people have access to services, and partnership with VANDU and other downtown east side advocacy organizations. And in addition, they'll be working in partnership on the Murdered and Missing Women March with the Women's Center to make sure that that is able to go ahead as it does every February 14th at the corner of Main and Hastings, whether or not Hastings as an Olympic traffic lane or not, because these issues continue despite the Olympics. We know that Pivot is very active on the Olympic file. Also, community groups, the Power of Women group, is very active on the Olympic file as well in preparing for that protest. And the Carnegie Community Action Project as well is very active on the issue of ensuring that homeless people are protected from street sweeps come the Olympic Games. And on the ticket issue, almost every organization in the neighborhood is active in ensuring that people don't get hauled to jail for unpaid tickets that were issued in December of last year when the police went on a ticketing blitz.
So if people are listening are reasonably outraged by what they're hearing about the situation, and is there other things that they can do in addition to training to be legal observers?
Absolutely. The observer role is very passive and neutral, but there are a number of organizations that are campaigning on various issues around the Olympics, everyone from the Council of Canadians to the Olympic Resistance Network, the ORN, to VANDU or other community groups in the downtown east side. A quick Google search will let you know who is doing advocacy on the issues you're interested in, whether it's the environment or social issues or otherwise. And at this point, from a civil liberties perspective, all perspectives are welcome, of course, that whether you're pro-Olympic, anti-Olympic, whether you think the money should be spent on healthcare, or whether you think it should be spent on ski jumping. But the issue is that these voices should be allowed to be spoken. So it's our feeling that people should really consider joining up and speaking out on the issue that's interesting to them, because there is this very concerted effort to limit free speech. And we think the Olympics represents a real precedent in terms of limiting Canadian free speech, which should really be nipped in the bud.
Well, thanks so much for coming down and joining us and sharing a little bit more about this.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with David Eby. He is the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. And if you're interested in being a legal observer during the games, again, you can register by emailing info@bccla.org.